the wake of the Trump election in the United States, liberals and so-called progressives are freaking the fuck out. But while they soul search about how this awful situation could possibly come to be, racialized peeps are being attacked and harassed in the streets. Clearly, the time has come to step up our game. So to learn a bit more about what that might entail and what white peeps can do in particular, I recently caught up with Connor and Beth, two members of Redneck Revolt. Hey y'all, how the fuck are you?
Really, just about as good as we were last week.
As good as it can be in the end times, right?
In the immediate aftermath of the recent election, we've heard a lot of talk about how the United States has become a deeply divided nation. Is this something new, or has this always been the case, and people just didn't notice?
Well, I think it's obvious that the country's always been divided into the rich and everyone else. Our part in that discussion is to draw attention to the historical divide between workers of color and the white working class. Because the white working class has historically found allegiances with rich white people instead of their fellow workers. The majority of white working folks have been recuperated into being foot soldiers for landlords, bosses, the state, thinking that that will buy them access into white supremacy as a system that benefits them, when in reality, a lot of white workers and their family end up being poor because they have aided the enemy, the rich, in keeping power. The working class has been divided by, you know, turning their justifiable class rage against migrants and workers of color instead of against the rich. I also think that American capitalism is so deeply embedded in the bootstraps mentality that it's almost like a religion. Not only has that mindset kept white working class folks from blaming the state for their struggle, but it has been really effective at creating an aspirational identification with the middle class and to some extent even the upper class. And it's much easier to divide an oppressed working class from solidarity with their neighbors when you create this culture that looks down on their struggle and really makes them believe that they can do better if they just work harder. That lack of identification with the struggle of others in the working class becomes even more difficult to bridge when we already have historical differences based on race and cultural differences. One thing that I think is worth pointing out, because right now, you know, the internet's really hot with people pointing fingers and shit, assigning blame, but it is worth recognizing that a lot of the states that went to Obama went to Trump this go around, which means that there is more nuance to the reasons than just overt racism. We on the radical left need to be much more aware of classism within ourselves and not make the same mistake as the liberals do, as just dismissing the working class as this caricature, the backwards country folk that are too simple and uneducated to reach, you know, that we are the working class. And any lack of identification with that on our part is just a holdover from liberalism.
There's also been a lot of finger pointing going on lately, with many leftist liberals and so-called progressives pinning much of the blame for how the election went down on the supposedly backward nature of uneducated white working class voters. Why do you think these peeps were so shocked by the scale of support for Trump, and what does that say about the current state of the left?
So obviously the white working class isn't backwards. The major issue is that they've been completely abandoned to the right, and the right has been able to recuperate them by offering easy answers to very complex problems and speaking directly to the conditions that most working class folks are facing every day. And the left has failed to do that in the last several decades, especially. Instead of working to push white workers to see their daily struggles as also being involved in the struggles of working class folks of color, and especially migrants, the left would rather treat them as too far gone to join in, you know, struggles for justice and liberty. It's also been a huge problem where the people of power in the left, and I'm talking in this instance in the institutionalized left, like the politicians, but also the leaders of a lot of social movements, come from the affluent classes of white folks. And so they don't have anything in common with the white working class. A lot of the organizing that's done by the institutional left really relies on this very paternalistic and charity-driven, and I would argue almost anthropopathic style of organizing, where they treat the white working class as though they are this separate population that they need to study and understand and speak to in a different language, rather than actually trying to meet them on the ground where they're at. And in that way, they've not been able to relate to white working class folks, obviously, and their organizing being driven by a lot of like white guilt and paternalistic feelings and LA politics towards that. It's just none of it is resonating with the white working class. And they're completely missing the point that the only way that we can actually threaten the state and capitalism is by actually aligning across those divides. It's also, I mean, the institutional left ceased representing the white working class a long time ago. They stopped really representing any strong union interests. They started pushing free trade agreements. You know, they spoke only to the middle class, the interests of the middle class and the college educated. And there was just this consistent structure of speaking to the, you know, the middle class and dismissing entirely the white working class as though they were too backwards or too far gone to represent. And so why would they be so surprised that they completely alienated that demographic? The problem with liberals across the board is that they weighed too heavily on this idea that they were the party or the group that wasn't doing any evil. But at some point, folks are going to demand receipts for all the alleged good they were doing, and there just isn't much to show for it.
How the fuck did a billionaire real estate tycoon like the Donald manage to pull off playing the role of the anti-establishment candidate?
Well, obviously, I think we all recognize that Donald Trump speaks in a way that really resonated with working class folks. You know, they're constantly referring to him as shooting from the hip, being genuine, straight shooter. You know, he played this anti-PC role that a lot of working class folks can relate to. And, you know, with their style of humor, but also he wasn't trying to police anybody's language or behavior. And because the institutional left and especially our social justice movements have really entrenched this idea of like, everything you're doing is wrong and how could you not already know that? And this very paternalistic top-down approach to having those conversations, I think folks are just genuinely relieved to have somebody that they saw as a potential leader who didn't approach things that way or talk to them that way. He also came out really strongly against neoliberal capitalist models like NAFTA and the free trade area of the Americas. And folks recognize that they are feeling the daily effects of those jobs, you know, being outsourced. And so having somebody speak directly to those realities and talking sort of like them goes a long way. The other thing though is that a lot of working class folks are not necessarily all in for Trump. They still view him with a lot of distrust. There's just a general mentality around wanting change. And that is something that is shared on all sides. You know, the people on the left are just as easily fooled and recuperated into a change candidate. We watch them do the same thing with Obama. We watch them do the same thing with Bernie. There's really very little question that a Bernie presidency would have been as uninspiring as the Obama presidency was. And the institutional left would have held their tongue and held their criticism and towed the party line like always. And, you know, there wouldn't have been this change. But the left is no more immune to this kind of desperate defense of any candidate that feels like things are going to be different in their lived realities. And so this tendency to look at everything that the folks on the right do as not recognizable within our own structures is part of what is making that conversation so difficult.
Within the context of renewed black-led resistance to white supremacist police terror and an atmosphere of increasingly generalized Islamophobia, over the past several years, the United Snakes has witnessed a dramatic rise in reactionary white paramilitary violence. Can you speak to the role that this type of violence plays in terms of maintaining white supremacy and reinforcing the domination of the state and capitalism?
Yeah. So by offering really simplistic answers and being able to point the finger at populations of people that were already marginalized within our current political structure, it's been really easy to work white working class folks into a frenzy. Historically, when populations of folks have lost a lot of access to resources, you know, call it privilege, whatever, there has been this shift to blame. In this case, we're talking about the loss of jobs, homes, you know, opportunities for advancement, long-term security, food, you know, these are all really vital things that have been slowly slipping away, and especially over the course of the last several generations, and people are looking for somebody to blame. And since very few of the, you know, the elements on our side of the barricade are actively trying to organize folks to target their actual enemies, and the right wing is heavily focused on that, they continue to play the foot soldiers of white supremacy and divide the working class. They keep the struggle and the violence contained within the working class, which again reinstitutes the power of the state overall. It benefits the neoliberals as well. Capitalism is maintaining its struggle in all of our communities because of that division. We also need to take a really hard look at the way that the institutional left has, again, driven the conversation about the resistance of folks of color and all the uprisings that we've seen over the last several years into these very useless academic hand-wringing conversations about white guilt and privilege. The concept of privilege has been so buzzworded into so many meaningless lectures from groups like Surge that it's now useless for dialogue. You know, there has been no incorporation of material support for that resistance, no recognition of shared oppression under capitalism, classism, state violence, while the loudest white voices that are discussing white supremacy are all shame and guilt driven with no acknowledgement of lived struggles of the working class. Folks are gonna have a hard time identifying with black, brown, and red resistance. Even now, when you look at a lot of the ally politics surrounding the Standing Rock defense camps, there's this strong tendency for white folks to associate the actions with environmental defense and not cultural defense against capitalism and genocide and colonialism. There is not opposition to state violence and oppression as a systemic and shared experience among the institutional left. But so I feel like white folks recognizing that they have a stake in the fight against white supremacy itself is incredibly important, as well as addressing the obligation that we have to use our access to white spaces and our complicity in white supremacy to actively work against it. But we are much more effective working against it when we're not being hampered by white guilt and liberal ally politics. All of those things end up playing into the same, you know, respectability politics that fight against and downplay the black and brown and red resistance that has been going on, you know, and continue to divide the white working class from those movements.
What strategies should revolutionaries in the United States be undertaken to address this recent surge in racially motivated attacks?
Well, Redneck Revolt promotes a two-part strategy for organizing against this growing reactionary and fascist working class. White anti-racists and revolutionaries need to be digging in for a long fight with for the hearts and souls of our neighbors, family members, friends, and community members. We need to be taking over and making space for anti-racist education from a working class perspective. In the cultural spaces already dominated by the white working class, anywhere people use as spaces of convergence, gun shows, concerts, swap meets, bowling alleys, barbecues, baseball games, corner bar, parties, hangouts, places where our families and friends frequent. We need to be connecting their daily struggles to the daily struggles of workers of color and helping cement those similarities in people's minds. We need to be actually organizing our communities against white supremacy and capitalism. At the same time, we got to be able to defend our neighborhoods, communities, and collaborate with others to build strong movements of resistance. We advocate for coalitions of community defense initiatives, networks that work to build armed and unarmed defense of marginalized communities, including white working class communities, from reactionary attacks at both the street and systemic levels. As long as our enemies are heavily armed, we need to be knowledgeable of how to fight that threat without resorting to oppressive state powers. We also have to insert ourselves directly into the areas where militant reactionaries radicalize and recruit. We have to meet people where they're at, you know? Otherwise, we're always going to have a steady flow of people ready to plan these attacks. This is our dual strategy that we offer at Redneck Revolt, organize and prepare to defend.
The Trump campaign served as a clarion call for a loose coalition of neo-Nazis and other white reactionaries, many of whom have coalesced under the umbrella of the so-called alt-right. What do you make of this movement, and how do you expect things to play out now that their candidate has been elected?
Well, I fully expect there's going to be resistance to Trump, just like there was to Obama and the Tea Party movement. I think if the resistance is successful, even in a minor way, which it very well could be, there's a good chance that these folks of the alt-right will mobilize to defend, you know, everything that they hope could have happened under a Trump presidency. We've got to show that we can counter these initiatives with at least equal force and better organization. Following is when, you know, we've heard talk of Trump adding far-right economic conservatives to his cabinet and transition team. We've heard talk about Kobach, Chris Kobach here from Kansas, who authored, you know, racist legislation all around the country, including like SB, I think it was 1170 over out in Arizona. We got Sam Brownback, might be his Secretary of Agriculture. So like this makes it clear that as time progresses and Trump's policies have a chance to play out, that they're going to negatively impact working and poor people's lives. Obviously, we've known this, but this is going to cause fissures to open up among his supporters. And our network intends to be active in exploiting these splits and to be ready to work with newly disillusioned people who found hope in Trump's campaign at one time.
Can you tell us a bit about your group, Redneck Revolt, and your affiliate project, the John Brown Gun Club?
So Redneck Revolt is a national umbrella which attempts to offer resources, direction, and organization to individuals and branches across the country. We hope to see branches continue to form in as many locations as possible, and we're encouraging individuals interested in forming a branch to contact us, find out if a branch has already been formed, or find out how to form one of their own. Branches will engage in activities ranging from outreach with historical, political, economic, and social analysis, was networking with other groups of marginalized folks, leftists and anti-capitalists and anti-racists, to basic firearm acquaintance and safety, community defense, legal assistance, and more. The National Network is going to raise funds through branches and through coordinated fundraising efforts to support situations, outreach materials, supplies, and legal and medical support for individual branches. A number of chapters have already formed, and interest is growing by the day. We've gotten, especially since the election, we've just gotten dozens of emails and messages on our Facebook page about, you know, do you have a chapter here? I want to start a chapter here. So, like, as this sense of urgency deepens following Trump's victory, we're just looking forward to having chapters form just about anywhere possible. Several chapters have chosen to stick with the name Redneck Revolt, and then, like, Phoenix, for example, has chosen to call their branch the John Brown Gun Club, of course in reference to the legacy of John Brown, but also referencing a similar project undertaken years ago right here in Lawrence that became the inspiration for Redneck Revolt. Mainly based on just basic familiarity with guns, practicing shooting, field stripping, cleaning, maintenance, all that stuff, and then also outreach at gun shows. So people would go table, sometimes they'd have like a video of the Black Panthers playing on a little TV, they'd have a few guns out on the table, and a bunch of anti-racist literature that was kind of like geared towards the working class. So conversations would happen, you know, people would come up and ask what it was about, and here we are a few years later, getting it back going again with like a lot more force, organization, and like a broader scope, I think.
Anything else you want to add?
I think, you know, the main focus of Redneck Revolt and the John Brown Gun Clubs is not actually to speak to a radical left or an anarchist audience. It really is to, you know, go back to our roots and recognize that we are largely the white working class. We have the ability to actually talk about our lived experiences in a way that is social insertion and that is really important for changing the conversations. But the other side of it that is really important is that everybody who is going to be accessing like this interview, for instance, is coming from the radical left, and that we need to take a very hard look as, you know, as are a movement, at the way that we have allowed classism and liberalism to really affect the way that we interact with folks, and the way that we have been also just as dismissive of the white working class, that we have also, you know, fallen in line with these bad academic privilege models that, and this jargon, and, you know, we've created our own code speak that does not allow access. And, you know, instead of meeting people where they're at and having those conversations and moving things forward, we have been very dead set on finding people that are already on the exact same page as us. And that is an echo chamber. It has not been useful, has not been helpful, and it has contributed to the current state of affairs, obviously on a much lower level than the institutional left or, you know, the institutional right wings. But we have not moved the needle forward on those conversations, and we have to take accountability for that and actually start to do that.
I think, speaking a little bit to the organizing within white working class communities, I think one of the challenges I see come up a lot is the difficulty of stepping back into working with people and communities that leftists and other radicals have at some point like worked to escape. Not that trauma is unique to any group in our society, but I think a lot of us retain at least some level of trauma from economic and social struggles that we face growing up in working class communities. Trans folks, queer folks, it's just like, yeah, I mean, it's tough, you know? I mean, there's so many levels of that trauma, and everybody deals with it. Family shit. It's like, how do you convince somebody to just, like, escape that shit to want to lean back into it and try to work with those people again? I don't know. It's tough.